Welcome to the Week in IndyCar on the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires. Been in the mood to try some different things of late, so we're going to do a cold open here. We'll bring in our guest this week, DJ Willie P. Will Power, your reigning Indy 500 winner, also the 2014 Verizon IndyCar Series champion with Team Penske. So we'll call Will here in just a few moments. He's been running around. We spoke earlier today. He was headed to the dumps, so getting some very important honeydew items checked off the list before we roll off to Mid-Ohio this weekend. So with that said, Mid-Ohio is going to be the site of our second Marshall Pruitt Podcast live event. We're going to do that Friday, starting at 5:30 p.m. in Victory Lane. Victory Lane is the new Victory Lanes, right behind Pit Lane. Normally, you need a pit pass to get in. That's not going to be the case. So if you're in and around the paddock, if you can cruise by, we would love to have you. We're going to have an all-Ohio panel of guests in Graham Rahal, team owner Michael Schenck, and young flame-on Johnny Blaze, a.k.a. Zach Veach. So we'll have our Ohio trio. We're also going to have at least one guest, surprise guest, stopping by about halfway through, maybe more than that. Another fun thing, too, is our friends at Toronto Motorsports, the ones who do the cool little MP stickers and all the other stickers you've probably seen floating around, that also do t-shirts as well. We have some brand new Marshall Pruitt Podcast t-shirts for our Week in IndyCar cartoon and also the Week in Sports Cars cartoon. So one of the things we will be doing for the live podcast on Friday is we are going to be giving away the some of the new Week in IndyCar t-shirts to all those who have their questions posed. So it's pretty fun, simple little thing. It's about a half hour long, and like we kicked off at Road America last month, it's just basically me opening with a question or two for our guests, and then we spend the rest of the time just asking you all to raise something fun, something interesting to the guest panel. And so for all of those of you who do, we're going to have some mediums, some larges, and extra larges to give away. So anyways, just a little bit of an appreciation for the ongoing love and support you give me, Toronto Motorsports, our friends at Cooper Tires, and also the Justice Brothers who are supporting us this month of July. And with that said, we will be right back. This month, the Marshall Pruitt Podcast is being supported by the Justice Brothers, whose line of additives, lubricants, and cleaners are America's brand for quality. The products are also used and proven by the world's top racing teams. So if you're interested in joining the sales and distribution team, Justice Brothers offers products for the automotive, semi-truck, agricultural, and industrial markets. To learn more, please check out their website at justicebrothers.com. Another thing I figure on the topic of different approaches and different tactics, last week, we tried splitting up the podcast. Well, I did more than try. We actually succeeded in doing that. Splitting up the discussion and analysis from the Q&A. And this week, for the most part, unless you have seen that I've done differently, I think this is just going to be a single episode because Will only has 50 minutes to about an hour or so. So I think general practice is, if the episodes are about an hour long, I'll probably just keep them one single file. If we get out to about an hour and a half or longer, which can happen, it's probably the instances where I'll split them up. Keep in mind, there's nothing changing in terms of the podcast. It's just a difference between having one single file to listen to or rolling from one into the other when we do split them into separate Q&A and separate discussion bits. What else comes to mind here? I'll be staying out, actually, once I fly out from Mid-Ohio. I'll be staying out because the following weekend, I have IMSA at Road America. We'll actually be doing our third Marshall Pruitt Podcast live event there in Victory Lane once again. This will be the Week in Sports Cars edition, and I have two of the three guests locked down so far. So we will have good old Elio Castroneves. And yes, it is really strange to think of Elio being a sports car guy still. And we'll also have two-time IMSA champion Christina Nielsen, who is just all kinds of awesome and kick-ass. And not sure on the third, Corvette Racing might have a guest to be there, and I might look somewhere else in the GTLM paddock. But these little live events seem to be gaining some momentum. I know that I was talking with one manufacturer today that has asked me to put one on at the IMSA season finale at Petit Le Mans. I believe we'll be doing another one at the Portland IndyCar race, and I won't be at Pocono. That weekend always conflicts with the Monterey Reunion Vintage event, which I head to and cover for Racer there while Robin is in Pocono. But I think there might be a good possibility Robin and I, and maybe one or two other guests, will be doing something at Gateway. So in theory, we could have some additional live IndyCar podcast events at after Mid-Ohio, at least, at three of the final four races on the calendar. And shoot, what else? You know, I think that might be about it. So let's kick off here with our boy DJ Willie P. And I apologize in advance if it gets weird or crazy or strange. But if you're listening, you know, that's just kind of what we expect from our favorite kid from Toowoomba, Australia. DJ Willie P, we had you on a couple times in the month of May after a certain race you won there. That was a blast. And then you were a part of the cast of the first ever live podcast that I did at Road America. So thanks. I guess I duped you into coming back. Thanks for joining in again, brother.
Yeah, I didn't even know what it was. So you did. You just tricked me into this. No, it's all good. I always enjoy it.
So we're heading into Mid-Ohio this weekend. And just before I rang, I was typing up a little something that I'll file here shortly, how this tends to be a race, I think, each year with where it falls in the calendar, usually with four, five, six races left. Mid-Ohio always seems to be a turning point in some way, shape, or form. It seems that for those who are kind of just holding on to championship aspirations, it's the race where if they don't make something special happen, you know, barring a miracle, they're kind of out of the conversation. Then we got some folks like you in fifth, Ryan Hunter-Reay in fourth, Rossi in third, Newgarden as well, all chasing Dixon, where, you know, you're not out of the championship hunt by any means, but, you know, the odds are starting to tell us five rounds to go. If you're going to make a move, you certainly don't want to wait until Pocono or Gateway or even Portland to make it happen. How do you think of a weekend like this as you're going in? Do you let that stuff soak in at all, or do you just try and intentionally play dumb?
Well, Toronto was usually that race for me, is that point of the season where you need to be heading in a certain direction, and went the wrong way for me this year. So Mid-Ohio is a pretty important race, I would say, to finish ahead of Dixon, simply. Because, you know, you start making that his lead even bigger from where I'm sitting, it becomes difficult. Obviously, you know, it's not over until it's mathematically over, because we've got double points at the end, and there's a huge swing there. But, yes, we need a strong weekend. It's not a matter of a strong weekend. We just need a weekend with zero mistakes. And that's what's happened to me this year. I mean, I've been, every time I finish a race without a mistake, we run so strong. So kind of need that for the last five races, and I feel like we got a shot.
You know, one thing that I think might have been overstated a little bit, and I'm probably guilty of that as well, is, you know, going into Mid-Ohio. A lot of us talk about it being, you know, you can rename the place Scott Dixonville or something like that. But, you know, it's not like he's won every race there. You know, his last win, 2014. So I realize that wasn't exactly ages ago. But, you know, others can win there. You can win there. What comes to mind about Mid-Ohio in terms of just a type of a track that might suit you? And maybe might be a place where you can, you know, take some points off of either Dixon or some of the others that you're chasing in this title hunt.
Well, I've led a lot of laps there. I've had quite a few pole positions there, but I've never won that race. So it's very high on my list. I think there's only two tracks that I've been to over, you know, more than five times that I haven't won on, and that's Iowa and Mid-Ohio. So, yeah, I've been thinking about this track, trying to win it for so long. I finished second a lot of times, but very strong at Mid-Ohio. Really enjoy the track. Going to be super tight in qualifying this year, simply because, you know, you've got such parity in the series right now with common body kits, and Chevy and Honda are very close. So it'll be a tough weekend to get in the top six in qualifying, but in qualifying means a lot there because it's difficult to pass.
So this might be a strange way of phrasing it, because you are in the middle of another championship run, legitimate contender for that title. Are you able to enjoy the fact that not only are you in that hunt, but you've got some really quality characters around you, whether it's Wickens right behind you in sixth, Rossi again is kind of asserting himself as a real contender wherever we go. Hunter Ray is there in fourth. Are you able to appreciate that whatever you achieve, whether it's a win or a championship, it's not just against really deep, you know, quality of fields and teams and whatnot, but these are some guys who are freaking animals, man. Does that add anything for it to you?
It does. That sums up what winning a championship means in this series is the competition level. And, you know, you can't pick a driver. And everyone you name just there, you know that all those guys are absolutely capable of winning a championship, and will, for the ones that haven't won a championship, where there's only, two or three of them, you know that they will. So it's just fierce competition through the whole field. It's, I just really enjoy racing against these guys. And, you know, the way the series has been going with a lot of continuity year in, year out. You're competing against these guys year after year, so, you know, it creates a lot of respect among each other, and, it's very fierce, tight racing, but it's, somewhat fair. But when you're winning an IndyCar, you're winning against some pretty, pretty good, the best in the world as far as, driving IndyCars.
You and I used to talk about this a lot when you were embroiled in the middle of it, how shortly after you went full-time with Team Penske, it became essentially the Power and Franchitti show, seemingly almost everywhere we went for a good number of years. The two of you seemed to bring out the best in each other. I don't want to say the worst at times, but, you know, there was some bodywork carving and wheels banging going on. But it really seemed like the Will versus Dario rivalry was really something special at the beginning of this decade. I mean, Dario unfortunately had to retire after his big crash in 2013. Looking at some of the guys we just discussed that you're in this title hunt with, are there any that you would look at now and say, you know, it feels like since Dario, maybe me and this person have had a little bit of a rivalry, or, hey, you know, I've really picked up some little things here there from some other folks after Franchitti.
I've definitely picked up things from all my teammates, no question. You can learn something from everyone in the field. But there hasn't been a single person that I've had a tough rivalry with. I fought with Simon for the championship in 2016, which was a pretty good fight. And then, obviously, last year was kind of not the best year for me. But, you know, they're all great drivers. You learn a lot off all of them. And, it seems though, just when you think IndyCar can't get any more competitive, every year it does. It's simply because everyone is learning off each other. You know, a classic example was Toronto, right? Dixon was a half second clear of the field on the first day, and then suddenly on the second day, everyone is up on him. You know, every sudden he's, you know, P2 or 3 in the next, you know, in the next practice, the next day. Just shows with onboard cameras, sector analysis, Dartfish, and all the data, especially with the multi-car teams, that you just can't sit still for a second because you're going to get beaten. Like, it's almost bad to set a really good pace on the first day because you know that everyone's going to learn from it. It's just, you just can't hide a thing anymore.
Plus, you don't want to feel like you found all your best stuff on day one and might have run out of ideas for day two.
Exactly, yeah. So it's different. Just these days, it's such a different animal to what it was. Like, it's really all about, dissecting data and understanding how to apply that to the track. That's kind of one of the talents that you have to have to be very quick these days.
Well, I think what we need to do is, after the first session at Mid-Ohio, you need to get out of the car, walk up to one of the really, like, real sweethearts, like a Wickens or a Hinchcliffe or Zach Veach, and just shove him really hard and just start yelling at him for no, you know, let's get some sort of rivalry going, but not one anyone would expect. Just folks saying, what the hell is wrong with Power? But more importantly, what did that other guy do? You know, just a little something. We'll create an artificial rivalry.
That happened at Barber with Pagenaud and Gabby Chavez.
Well, I think, as I wrote at the time and I've written many times, that was a pillow fight. You know, I love both guys, and I'm sure Gabby, with his mixed martial arts experience, could probably lump me up if I wasn't careful, but, you know.
Is he really a mixed martial art?
Yeah. He's been training in Brazilian jiu-jitsu for years and years and years and years. So, yeah, he's, you know, he's only like 3 foot nine. But, yeah, I mean, that guy, trust me, he'll wear out my kneecaps and everything else. So, yeah, that was an unexpected gem to find out, too, by the way. Cause,
that's good to know. I need to know that stuff if something happens. You need to know your competition out of the car. Because Robert Miller always asks who's the guy that you would least like to fight.
And you're P1. You're kind of...
Yeah, but sounds like Gabby Chavez is going to be P1 now.
Well, he might either choke you out, get a triangle going, make you tap with an arm bar. I mean, that would be awesome to see on pit lane.
Big news.
And Miller and I still need to write. We've been talking about doing this since the month of May. If we need to do our top 10, you know, all-time IndyCar drivers you wouldn't want to fight. And I think most people would put Foyt first. But I don't know. There could be some good surprises in there. And maybe it wouldn't be a fight. Maybe, you know, you'd wake up and find that little red laser dot on your forehead because some of the guys are a little bit crazy. But we definitely need to get that story done. Let's take a look at a couple other things, Will, before we jump into Q&A here. So we're going into Mid-Ohio. Then we're going to Pocono, Gateway, Portland, Sonoma. I mean, we're here more or less at the end of July, and by the middle of September, you know, seven weeks from now, we're done. Tell me about the mindset going into this kind of frenetic pace of wrapping up the season in a short amount of time. Do you have enough time to feel centered, balanced, you know, locked in focus-wise, or does it feel like you're about to jump on another roller coaster?
No, I tell you, I like it when it's back to back to back to back. I mean, it really works in my favor. You know, I don't like having weeks off, so kind of like to get going, because then you're in the rhythm. You know, you're working with your engineer week in, week out, and you're just getting a good flow. So I think, you know, it's going to be interesting. We've been, qualifying average this year is something like 2.5.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have the speed. We've just got to put the races together. And, you know, it's been my fault too many times this year.
So let's look at you specifically – and evolution-wise here, going back to another topic that you and I used to discuss all the time, but really not so much in recent years, it was mindsets, right? What's the right mindset should I be in? Should I be more aggressive? Should I be more relaxed? Should I be the guy who's just obsessive-compulsive when it comes to looking through data? Should I just not look at data and let it flow naturally? Where are you at, I guess, not just this year, but as we head into these final races? What's the magic mindset for you?
Yeah, I think you just find your own mindset when you're doing a lot of races or when you're in the middle of the season, because it just, because you're doing it so often, it should become kind of second nature. Where you can jump in and really perform at the drop of a hat. I've been through so many different mindsets in my career, and you know, I've won races with so many different mindsets, so it's hard to say. But at the end of the day, when you do the work and you know you're putting it together without mistakes, and you know what you want from the car, you're in a good place. You know, when you start getting confused and not understanding why you're struggling, that's you know, that's when you're in a bad place. You know, it's, you know, through your career you go up and down like that. You know, it's just like a golfer when they you know, when they go through a patch of just having a bad time. So it's in any sport, but the more experience you have, the more you can tap into that area where it's just spot on.
Going to ask final question here, and I think we might have had a listener to ask the same. Mazda Raceway Laguna Seca, which has now become WeatherTech Raceway Laguna Seca, which I think back in the day we all just knew as Laguna Seca. That's going to be our new season finale next year. Haven't had a chance to ask you your thoughts on this. Are you a fan of the idea? Neutral? What comes to mind?
I love Sonoma. It's a fantastic track. I don't know the ins and outs of why we end up going to Laguna Seca, but I also love Laguna Seca. There's a lot of history there. It's a fantastic track, and really look forward to racing there. But it is the finale, is it? I didn't know that.
Mark Miles, I asked if Gateway and making Gateway the finale after 19 was an option, and while he didn't say it in so many words, he intimated like Laguna might be the finale by contract, you know, contractually for the entire 3-year span that it's going to be on the calendar. So it looks like that might be the place where we are closing the season through 2021.
Okay. Well, good to know. I'll have to do more podcasts with you because I find out all sorts of new information.
Well, we're done here. We'll save it till afterwards. Another thing we tend to catch up on when we can is either movies, books, documentaries, or otherwise that have piqued our respective interests. What's either on TV at the Powerhouse Hold, or what books you've been reading lately that you might suggest?
I just finished a book called Living with the Monks, and it's Jesse, I think it's Itzler is his name. I read his book when he was living with a seal for a month, but he lived with some monks. It's a pretty easy read, pretty funny. It's a guy who has a very busy lifestyle and is inundated with text messages and emails and just constantly on the go, and then goes and lives at with a group of monks up in upstate New York, I think. But anyway, it's out in the middle of nowhere, and it's a very interesting book when he has to learn how to sit without talking to anyone, you know, for hours at a time, which he has never done in his life. So
wow.
I kind of liked it. Yeah, there's some good messages in there. Interesting. It's made me think that maybe I should go do that. That sounds like you would read it and say that does not sound like fun. Doing mundane exercises, not exercises, but chores, you could say, like just cleaning the floor. But the monks just love it. They put a lot of effort and heart and a 100% in the moment when they're scrubbing the floor of the church.
Wow.
And he's there doing it too.
And see,
so yeah, interesting.
This is one of the things that I hope our listeners and more IndyCar fans will come to appreciate about you. It's something that Robin and I tried to drive home when you won the 500 and after, that, you know, the willpower that I think many fans have come to know throughout the years on TV or otherwise, there's a much deeper character behind it. And I'm not trying to blow smoke here, but I could probably ask each one of the full-time IndyCar drivers, hey, what's the name of the last book you read, and how recently did you read it? And I would either get a laugh or a book. What is a book? This is just one of those things where not many folks might realize that you're a guy who has always, at least since I've known you, been someone who said, hey, what is this thing I can do that I can either read or listen to? What's this thing I can input into my brain that will help me, show me a different perspective about life, and knowing that in some way it will benefit you either as a person, as a professional, as an athlete. Everyone goes to the gym. Everyone tries to eat healthy. Everyone works the physical side of the equation. Some folks do specific mental exercises to try and improve their craft behind the wheel, but there aren't many IndyCar drivers who are trying to expand their mind like you do. So just another point of appreciation.
Yeah, well, reading's better than watching a movie, in my opinion. You get way more detail. I'd much rather read a book than watch a movie. I guess I'm getting older. It's pretty lame.
Well, I was going to say, the one thing that has surprised me when I got back from the 500, my wife told me that there's a series on Netflix that I found that I really want you to see. And I'm like, yeah, okay, nope, you know, not a problem. We'll try and get to that as soon as I can. And, you know, my wife, who's born and raised in the projects in Montgomery, Alabama, if we're talking stereotypes, I would have never expected her to say, I fell in love watching The Crown on Netflix about Queen Elizabeth. And I ended up loving the dang thing too. We recently finished it, and I'm sitting here going, again, there's probably no one that would believe me that I'm sitting here just absolutely loving this little series on Netflix about Queen Elizabeth, et cetera, et cetera. So now, granted,
that sounds cool, actually, because I started looking up YouTube to try find out, you know, where the money has gone in the royal family over the centuries, actually. You know, when you start way back at what's his name, the guy who beheaded like seven wives.
Henry the eighth. Something like that. We'll just go with us here, yeah, if we're wrong. But yeah,
it's really, I saw it, and it's really, there's no bloodline there. It went in all sorts of weird directions of who became the king and queen. Yeah, it's interesting. I'm interested in that. I think I'm going to have to watch that now. Does it go into that detail?
It doesn't necessarily go that far back, but it's pretty interesting about her life coming up. This is all kind of centering around, you know, the 40s, 50s, 60s and such. And there's some quite interesting things about one former king actually being a Nazi sympathizer, and a few, you know, it's,
yeah,
interesting topics, but also the acting is just sublime. But while the things that you've read have actually helped you to expand your mind, I can say that what I just mentioned with The Crown actually just numbs my mind, so that probably wouldn't surprise anybody. All right, well, let's get into some questions here, as we do every week. Thanks to our friends at TorontoMotorsports.com, we give away something either a mug or a t-shirt to whomever asked the question I liked the most from the previous week. We're all out of mugs, so we're doing t-shirts now. And Toronto Motorsports has also given us a special little exclusive code for Marshall Pruitt podcast listeners through July 28th. So you got a couple days left. If you visit torontomotorsports.com, type in Indy, capital letters, I-N-D-Y, you'll save 25% on all IndyCar-related merchandise, including some of that highly, highly prestigious DJ Willie P stuff, diecast t-shirts, ball caps, stickers, and mugs. Did you like the sticker they did of you, the one with the aliens and all that kind of stuff after you won the 500?
Yeah, that was pretty interesting. You have to look deep into it to get all the little intricacies.
I suggested the water bottle. Yeah, the water bottle was my suggestion, so that's the only thing of value I contributed to that. So from last week, John Karasinski, I loved your question for our guest Chris Simmons, asking, was it difficult stepping away from driving and moving into full engineering role following his Indy Lights career? And then he also asked about having raced against some of the modern greats, Kanaan, Castroneves, D'Amata, who stuck out from his racing career as the toughest competitors he faced. So, John, send me a little DM on Facebook, and we will get you hooked up with a t-shirt of whatever size happens to interest you. All right, so, as usual, we've got a ton of great questions, Will. Some of them along very similar themes, so I'll try and condense those into one question. But I want to start here with one of my favorites. This is from Twitter. Simon Spikert says, Will, Low-End Theory or Midnight Marauders, which one is your favorite A Tribe Called Quest album? And I know you actually have a different answer.
Yeah, it's actually, I don't even know whether it's the name of the album, but I had to get it from my asked my brother when I was looking for it, because I got the album, you know, the one with Can I Kick It and
People's Instinctive Travels.
Yeah, it's called Seasoned Traveler.
Yes.
The remix. I don't know if it must be a remix. Yeah.
Is a special, yeah, a special release. And I know that you also had a CD version of it as well. Do you remember that?
Oh. Yeah, you gave me, did you give me that?
Oh, I didn't give it to you, you bastard. I lent it to you. Where was it? I think.
And then I bought it. Believe it or not, I bought another one in Australia and lost that. Like, I think so, or that might have been the one you gave me. When did you give it to me? Because I remember I was in Australia in 2000.
No, we were there. Yeah, it was like 10 or 11. We were there for the Gold Coast 600. I think it was the test day at Winton or whatever. And I was like, hey, you told me you've been looking for this forever, and I just happened to get it myself. You know, listen to it or whatever. And I'd forgotten about it like a year or two later. I'm like, hey, by the way, man, you still got that CD of Legend. You had this blank look like, oh, crap. So I've since bought it. So we're all good. I bought another version. So
you bought it. Yeah. Oh, I need to get it, man.
Well,
like, I haven't got it. Like, not get it, but I need to. Because you can't get it on iTunes. You can't get. Actually, I haven't been on iTunes for a long time. Maybe they got it there. It was like a two-pack song, Nothing But Love, and I couldn't find this really cool remix of it anywhere. It's like there's someone put the audio of it on YouTube. That's it. But you can't get it. You can't. I even sent iTunes an email saying, "Hey, where can I get this?"
Well, I'd offer to lend you my iPod, but I'm afraid I might not get it back. But we'll see what we can do. We'll get you taken care of here.
Yeah.
All right, we've got a question from Ralph Hibbard, who I see at least once or twice a year. He's always selling some great stuff at the Indie Memorabilia Show. So, Ralph, A, thanks for letting me give you money to take home things that my wife is like, seriously, dude, you don't have enough of this crap. Ralph says, Will, what was it like working for Derek Walker and Kevin Kalkoven at Team Australia? And feel free to curse all you want at them.
Yeah, no, Derek was definitely, one of the best team owners that I drove for. With the budget that he had and the way he ran his team, it was amazing. The performance that he would get out of everyone there. He was very good at picking drivers and very good at picking, you know, engineers, mechanics, everything. So Derek was really, you know, very instrumental in me kind of being able to progress to a point to drive someone like Penske. And, my year with KV and Kevin Kelkhoven was definitely my toughest year in motorsport. We were one of the transition teams during the merger. But, you know, they had a great team. Like, I feel like if I'd stayed on for another year, we would have been really competitive. Actually, feel like we would have been a championship contender the next year, you know, once we got on top of things. Both teams were great. It's kind of sad that they're not in IndyCar anymore. Because they're both well capable of winning races and championships.
Absolutely. Let's see. You know, we've got a bunch of questions about which Australian track you'd like to see on the IndyCar calendar or similar, so I'll come back to that in a moment. This question from Twitter, Brad at BZAD. I'm just saying, this might be an early top candidate for favorite question of the week. Brad says, Will, as an Australian, are you able to directly trace your lineage to a specific criminal, or is it a general all of them? So, shots fired to Australia and the prison colony, huh?
Yeah, I really want to do my homework on that and understand, that whole family tree where it started within Australia, but I know that we're from Ireland, the family originally. And my ancestors were prison guards, not criminals. But either way, they're both criminals.
See, I mean the
yeah. What, so I'm going to actually look into that.
I love that.
Good question.
As
good
you
question.
Should. My father always told me. Well, granted, my first name is Marshall. His name is Marshall. My grandfather's name is Marshall, was told that our first name was taken from the fact that we were indeed Marshalls in the South, in both Arkansas and Mississippi. So I think there was some form of general policing and whatnot back in the 1800s maybe. But my father also told me that there were some Pruitts that were hung for horse stealing and other crimes. So maybe we both have a lovely criminal past somewhere among our roots. Probably different criminals, but Brad, seriously, I was laughing crazy hard when you sent that in. Let's see, where else should we go? Victor Rad. All right. Would a current IndyCar set up for the bumpiest of street tracks be able to survive the Skyline Dipper elbow sections at Mount Panorama? What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. It's actually Mount Panorama is very smooth. It's a very smooth track. Well, as you know, we have some tracks with some pretty big compressions. You just set the car up accordingly. So, yes, we actually could race there, no problem. It would be pretty insane over the top of the mountain there, where if things went wrong, you could end up going over the edge of the mountain. But that would be a seriously crazy race, but fun.
And we'll kind of stick on the down under theme. Ryan Terpstra says, ignoring the logistics of getting okay from insurance or otherwise, do you have any interest in either doing the Bathurst 1000 or the Rolex 24 at Daytona? And you got a lot of questions about endurance racing interests, either now or whenever you're done with IndyCars, too.
Yeah, I definitely would like to do the Bathurst 1000 now that Penske has a V8 supercar team that's very strong down there. It's just finding the right time because, honestly, to do it properly, you'd have to do testing and be over there in the car, which would kind of disrupt your IndyCar season. So I just kind of struggle to understand how that would all work, but I would definitely like to do it.
And the other thing, too, which is might be of interest, is, you know, keep in mind that this is also the biggest supercars race on the calendar, means the most, very important from a championship standpoint. So, you know, it's one thing for someone to come in and say, I want to be in the Indy 500, you're racing the car by yourself, etc. It's another thing to look at wanting to do that at Bathurst, well into the championship calendar already, and knowing that you're going to be sharing the car with someone, and especially if we're talking the DJR Penske team, which has been, you know, a contender right away. It's not so easy to say, oh, our IndyCar guy has a dream of doing this, let's make it happen for him. You know, yeah. There are some much bigger considerations to take into mind here. So were it maybe an additional entry or something like that, I think that would be a lot easier, at least while you're full-time in IndyCar. But who knows? Maybe that's your next destination once you have decided to bid farewell to IndyCar. And what on that topic, and it's not like I'm asking you what year exactly, but, you know, do you look at IndyCar and say, okay, I 5 more years maybe, or 10, or don't put a number on it, until they kick me out, I'm going to be here. I mean, what comes to mind?
Exactly that.
Yeah.
No, I mean, can't put a number on it. You just don't know. You know, the older I get, the more experience you get, you know, and the more you realize that you really have to enjoy it and get the absolute most out of it. When you're, you know, week in, week out, lap after lap, because you're not going to be able to do this for the rest of your life. And, you know, maybe you can only do it for another 5 years. So enjoy it. That's the key.
You know, Brad from Twitter has another great question here. You're killing it today, Brad. He said, Will, have you ever been sitting in a team debrief, looked at Joseph, and thought to yourself, my God, that's a handsome man?
He actually reminds me of my brother. He kind of looks like him. I've never done that. I never actually thought Joseph was that attractive.
Good. We need to knock him down a peg or two. You know, you can't be
like
a young.
The worst thing that ever happened was someone told me he voted ESPN. ESPN voted him. What is it? Sexiest driver or best looking driver?
Something like that.
I was like, that was the last thing you need to tell that guy. Yeah. No, but he's all good. It's just funny. I give him a hard time all the time.
Oh, he's the best.
Yeah.
I mean, we mess with him constantly, and that's just part of the fun. He knows that is the recipe to a good life and career. When everyone's just nice to you all the time, that to me is pretty darn boring. We're going to stick with Twitter for a minute before we jump over to Facebook. Ryan Holman, love this, because now we have, you know, right on about 2 months of distance. Ryan asks, what did it feel like to win the Indy 500? And now that you do have a little bit of time and distance, has it sunk in yet? What do you wake up every morning and go, damn straight, Indy 500 winner? What's it like?
Well, any time the thought comes in my mind, every now and then I'll just be driving along and go, I won the Indy 500. I won the Indy. Like, it was something that had eluded me for so long. And, you know, I'd had days where I had cars that were just unbelievable, and it hadn't happened. So it was just fantastic, is all I can say. It was just fantastic. And, you know, I'll never forget that day. It was something that I really wanted to accomplish and was wondering if it would ever happen. To win a championship and an Indy 500, but particularly the Indy 500, was just, yeah, can't explain it. Every time I think about it, it brings a massive smile to my face. Absolutely loved it. Will savor that for a long time, forever.
Let's go to Francesco Sata, who asks, in the past, Will, you've been positive or mentioned positive things about possibly including DRS, drag reduction system, in IndyCar. I haven't read that, so I'm taking Francesco's word for it. Do you not think it would be detrimental to your skills as a driver?
Yeah, I think DRS potentially chance he makes the pass too easy. But I think with IndyCar, if they had a system that had a no reply push to pass system, I think that would be a pretty good balance, where you'd still have to get a really good run and the guy would defend and still be a pretty good fight. But on some of these tracks where the straights are really short, I think that would work well. If they had it at Road America this year, it would have been just an unbelievable epic battle. Yeah. You know, at the end, where, you know, the car in front cannot reply, but then he can, once he gets past it, to be on again and just go back and forth. So I think that's something worth trying. And it's probably crazy for me to say that, considering I'm a guy that qualifies really well and I have a very, very good qualifying average. So, you know, if I was the guy starting at the back, I'd be really politicking for that to happen. But if you qualify well and you're in a great team like Penske, you know, any of those DRS or, you know, even what I have been kind of telling IndyCar that might be good for competition, you know, is, you know, probably not the best for me. But I don't care. I mean, I just think it would create good racing. I'm all about, you know, making the show good, and you know, I think a lot of passing is, I think artificial passing, where it's just an artificial pass, you know, there's no skill involved, that's too much. You got to find the happy medium. I think obviously no passing at all is also boring, but somewhere in the middle, you know. I think the racing this year in IndyCar has sure been better, and then, you know, I can't give enough credit to Jay Fry and Bill Pappas, Tino Belli, for the way that they have built this car, because it's a lot of fun to drive. There's not much turbulence, and you know, it looks really cool. If you look at the race at Iowa, it was amazing. So, you know, these guys have done a fantastic job, and they're always looking too. You know, they're always looking to tweak and make it better. You know, it's just such a good group there in IndyCar that are, you know, in charge of the competition. Yeah, very good.
Next question comes from Ben on Twitter, and I appreciate this one because it'll help explain some of the black art of what folks like you and other elite drivers do. Ben asks, what feedback do you get through the car, whether through the steering wheel or the seat or otherwise, about the car's conditions, the car's condition as it changes in the race, you know, whether it's fuel burning off, tire wear, etc. So, you know, if folks watch in-car camera or a visor cam or otherwise, you can see some of the methods, or at least one major method that some drivers do, and that is you'll see an initial steering input into a corner, and it's not the actual hard turning the car input, it's just that little loading of the steering wheel to get some sort of feedback as to whether the front might skate or the back might move. It's kind of a looking for a quick tip as to what might be coming, to then use that to charge through the rest of the corner. But tell us about some of the points of feedback that even go in these crazy speeds, Will. How the car talks to you, what it's talking to you through, to kind of feed your brain input on how hard to go.
Yeah, it's the steering wheel, the steering weight, the feedback through the wheel is where you get a lot of the understanding of the balance of the car, the amount of grip, and what you've got as you go through the process of applying lock through a corner. In particular, on an oval, you know, your hand, the feel of the wheel is very important. And then obviously you feel with your whole body as well. You feel what the car's doing, and it's just all those sensors are telling you what it's doing. But the steering wheel in particular is probably one of the most important places that you understand what's going on with the car, because you can jump in a simulator where you don't get any G-force feedback and feedback of what the chassis is doing, and it can feel very real, and you're getting all that feeling and feedback through the steering wheel. So yes, that's And it's almost like a subconscious thing. When you've been racing a long time, it's just it's amazing when putting a qualifying lap together, how much it would just be really interesting to see the brain imaging during that process with how much is going on, like consciously and subconsciously, because it's just, it's crazy how much you have to take in at that speed, and how many of the senses in your body has to feel and understand what's going on in such short, you know, in just such split seconds all the time. It's just hard to explain. And I guess that's why you're so mentally drained after a race.
Yeah, and that's the, I mean, that's why you see some drivers, if we're talking qualifying in particular, or just having to do, you know, some really hard, ragged racing, you hear about folks trying to tap into their lizard brain, that kind of primal side of themselves, you know, whatever animal roots you might have, where it's not as if you aren't processing a bunch of things right up front, but, you know, there is something to, I don't want to say turning off your brain, but just acting, reacting, instincts. I mean, you're not able to sit there and go, how hard should I apply the brake entering this corner? I mean, it's, by the time you say that, you're already sliding off into the gravel. I mean, there is something to being able to just perform without your brain being in front of you the whole time.
Yeah, it's like a mixture. You know, it's kind of, it's interesting because, you know, conditions change and wind changes and tire changes and fuel load changes, and you're always having to be on your toes. It's never the same. It's never, ever the same. It's so crazy in racing. It's never the same. It's never the same corner. It always, every lap it changes because the fuel loads change, the tire pressures change, the temperature of the tires change, the track has changed, more rubber's gone down. I mean, it's just never, ever. It's just a very reactive sport. Very reactive.
Well, let's shift over to Facebook here, Will, to close. And again, we've got, as I mentioned to folks, we've got way more questions than we'll be able to get to with the time that we have. But there are some great questions here. The most popular one that has the most people giving it a like comes in from Jordan Darwin, who says, Will, could you please compare the first Lola Champ car you drove, the Panos DP01, and the current IndyCar, which, what do you like about each? Which is your favorite and why?
My favorite was the Panos DP01. Just the perfect balance of tire, horsepower, and weight. And, you know, very, very good front end on it. Really, really rotated well off brake, which suited my style at the time. And the very first Champ car I drove was also just just blew me away with the amount of power and just a fun, you know, I found like Champ car just a fun, brutal ring its neck type of car. You know, the more you wrung its neck, the faster you went. The current car, since the upgrades, is closer to that. It's, you know, more of a driver's car, and you know, things never just stuck. It always has some sort of imbalance. You you're kind of working the whole time, trying to you know, manipulate it in certain ways. So it's they all have their strengths and weaknesses, but I think the DP01 was my favorite car. IndyCar is going to another engine in 21, and I think that will actually have more power than what the Champ car had, because we're getting up there in power now. It's starting to get pretty close.
Yeah,
the speeds look very similar if you overlay a trace to a Champ car to what we have now. The top speeds and the acceleration is pretty close.
Daniel Kincaid asks, Will, what's your relationship with other key Aussie drivers like Mark Webber in Danny Ricciardo. And there's someone else who asked, did you consider doing a milk shoey in Victory Lane at the Indy 500?
Yeah, the milk shoey never even registered, actually.
Thank God. I mean, we would have committed you to a mental asylum if you had.
Yeah, because the champagne actually has alcohol in it, which is an antiseptic and kind of, you know, kills off the germs. But the milk does not, so you probably end up very sick and out for the rest of the year. But you still won the 500, so who cares?
Yeah. What about good old Weber and Danny?
Mark, yeah, still speak to Mark every now and then. He helped out my career, you know, at a time where I was in a pretty bad spot as far as you know, in a position where I was pretty much done. So yeah, he stepped up to help me, which is very cool. So yeah, we chat, you know, maybe once or twice a year now, not very often, but yeah. And Danny Ricciardo, I actually don't know, I've never met him. Love his work, always follow him, but haven't had the chance to meet him yet.
Robbie Bergren says, hey, Will, could you share a favorite story from your dirt racing days?
You know, when I won the Mulmerin 100 Lapper, the Mulmerin's a small town, you know, outside of Toowoomba, and I was running a production car, which was the slowest category. It was a Datsun 1200 Coupe. We actually had a 1400 engine in it. What? But I was up against some, you know, V8 cars with massive tires, like sprint car size tires, and it was and I actually won the race. I won, like, it was just, my car was so light and nimble, and it was just a fun race, and I still look back at that as one of my favorite wins. And I had the car, I was sitting there, I remember, after, you still had all the rubber donuts on the side from you know, battling with people, because a lot of cars on the track at the same time, so you're always in traffic, you're always passing. And I was very disappointed that my dad gave the car to our mechanic at the time, and his son took the engine out of it and put it in his road car, and they got rid of the shell. I was so mad. I was like, that was going in a museum. I won a few hundred laps in that on the dirt. I had a lot of fun on the dirt in that car, the Datsun Coupe. 1200 fastback.
See, that would be awesome to pass on to Bo as his first, you know, proper dirt racing car. I think we need to make that happen. We gotta start searching.
Yeah. I don't know where it is. I want to find it. I want to get the engine back. I'm gonna ring the guy. I need that car put back together.
Let's see, Nicholas.
I think it was number 12.
Really?
I actually think it was number 12, because when I was in juniors, I think I was like 16 or something, I had J12. I think it was 12. I have to find out. That would be so funny if that was the case.
That would be so awesome.
Yeah.
Let's see. Nicholas Sylvain says, in the very distant post-racing career future, what does life hold for Will Power? Owner, consultant, commentator, raconteur. Have you given any thought as to what you might want to do when you hang up the proverbial helmet?
I don't know. And it's a big, like, I just don't know. I mean, you have to, you know, have something to get up for every day. So, you know, it's been for 20 years now almost, you know, waking up with that thought of doing everything you need to do to be the best race car driver. So, whatever it is, I know that I'll put a lot of effort into it, because that's what I do, but I can't think of something. You know, I think it'll come to me as I get closer to, you know, close to the, when I would think about retiring. Doors kind of open up, but yeah, I just honestly can sit here right now and tell you that what I would do.
You know, we look at Rick Mears as the longtime oval master at Penske, passing down his knowledge. Maybe we need a road course, Matt. Since Rick has that education covered, maybe RP needs a road course master to school future generations. So, you know, that wouldn't be the worst. But knowing you, you'd find a way to get into a car somehow and have some fun. So, got another post-career question. Eric Franklin says, post-racing, let's say you're now the drummer in a cover band. Which band is it that you would want to cover night after night?
Oh.
And do you still drum? I know you've had your electric drums, but with a child.
I have been drumming a lot lately. And I've been playing Red Hot Chili Peppers. I always play them. Fall Out Boy. Play that. A bit of Faith No More. Song Evidence.
Faith No More. Good on you.
The song Evidence. And... what was that other song? The other song of that is Evidence and Epic, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Epic was another. I was playing that today. Epic, it's like big time. You're on the bass, your leg gets worn out. Yeah. So it would be one of those bands, Foo Fighters. I play Smashing Pumpkins stuff. It's a tough one to pick. Red Hot Chili Peppers for me is the was the easiest to learn. It's like pretty. It was good fun to play. So maybe that.
Let's see. Where should we go next as we wind down here? Will David Zitterbart, a fellow Australian, says Gold Coast aside, where would you like to see IndyCar go for a race? He says I think the Adelaide GP circuit would be great and would develop a strong following.
Yeah, could you imagine getting to do the Adelaide Grand Prix circuit?
Yeah.
Like, he's dead on there. I wouldn't have thought of that, but yes, that would be amazing.
Yeah, I blow through the fly over the first chicane, like some of the photos back in the day of Senna or whomever, 2 feet, 3 feet in the air. That would be, although you did that at Las Vegas, there's some great shots of you freaking heading into outer space with some of the height that you got. So yeah, that might be some fun there. All right, we're gonna find a couple more and then shut her down here. Justin Walsh says, Will, out of all the cars you've raced, which was the most challenging to drive on the limit?
Oh.
Doesn't have to be an Indy car.
Yeah. It is an Indy car, actually. I think it was I think the Champ car for sure was so hard with all that power and everything to extract everything out of it. So much energy went into it. When I remember. But, these, they're all have their own characteristic to extract the most out of them, and it seems to always require the same amount of energy that you have to put into it. So, but I would say the Champ car, like how much time you could find. Although, when you think about the sort of downforce that we had in the previous 2 years, to find the ultimate limit of that car was very difficult.
Insane.
It was so much grip and just kept coming. In those fast corners, the amount of speed you would carry. And it was a very tough limit to understand and feel because it was there and then it just let go. So, I would say that, as far as not being a very progressive car to understand what's going on, was pretty hard to get the full limit of it.
Alrighty, one or a couple more. Henri Fong, great question. Will, if for whatever reason you had to let another driver set up a car for you, which driver would you select to set up a car?
Elio was often very close to me as far as oval setups. If I was gonna pick someone's car, it would probably be Elio's on both. New Garden more recently has been closer to what I drive with this car. We've been pretty similar on setup. So, yeah, either of those two guys.
Let's see, two more to go. This one from Alicia Hirsch Rieske. I apologize if I murdered your last name there, Alicia. Says, congrats on winning the 500 this year. Who are your racing heroes, and how have they influenced your racing career?
Senna was obviously, like everyone's, was a one of my heroes, but actually Nelson Piquet, when I was a kid, was the F1 driver that I followed the most. He was a real hero of mine. And I got to race against his son, Nelsino, in British Formula 3. So that was who, you know, in that, the heroes for me were like Senna, Prost, Mansell, you know, Berger, all those guys in that era was just, you know, that was, when I was a little kid, watching those guys were, you know, they were my absolute heroes growing up, that era of Formula One. And yeah, it's funny, I didn't watch much IndyCar until in the 90s when I look at the field of the 99, you know, 98, 99 or 95 to 2000 guys in kart were also guys I really looked up to. I was a little older than in go-karts, but yeah.
I love the PK selection, by the way. That is definite. That's the unexpected gem from this conversation. All right, last question, and I've saved this one intentionally, goes to Grayson Gibson. It says, Will, do you think the aliens would be peaceful, or would they try to eradicate us, Independence Day style?
The aliens. I'm not an alien guy, to be honest.
Well, yeah. But you made the mistake at some point in your career saying that, you know, you're curious about something, so naturally we run with it and treat it like it's all you think about. So
yeah.
If we were to pretend...
Yeah, I think I watched something on YouTube, but...
what do you think? Oh, would they be friendly, well, or would they blow us out?
They would be friendly, because if they're able to travel to the Earth, they have a higher intelligence than we do, so... it seems as though the higher the intelligence, the less violence.
I'm also reminded of the Perry Farrell song, Porno for Pyros, Pets, where it essentially says, if aliens were to come, we'd make great pets. So that's what comes to mind, because if they have higher intelligence, I wonder if they'd just be kind of patting us on the head like we do with cats and dogs. So
probably.
And maybe we're like aliens to our pets.
Yeah. Well, what I was going to say is, like, you know, the higher intelligence generally don't, there's less violence, because rarely do you see two scientists brawling in a lab, as opposed to a couple of blokes in the pub.
That's a great point. I mean,
like, rarely would you see, you know, a scientist getting glass with a beaker, because
upside
the
head.
He didn't agree with the what do you call it? The sum or the equation.
Yes.
Didn't agree with the equation.
But see, at the same time, you know, we could point at our government here, and whether you're Republican, Democrat, doesn't matter, and realize that most of the folks in government have some form of college degree, university degree, have been, you know, have had to go through some form of serious education, and yet, they sure seem to come up with some violent things and restrictive things. So, you know, there might be a little bit of an out clause there for higher-minded beings.
They do, but they don't come up with violent things towards each other. They don't actually fight in the White House.
Now that I would love to see.
They don't actually brawl in the White House. Really, you just don't see that.
A cage match to sign a new bill. I like that. That would be. And see here, and somehow we've come back to fighting yet again. I am the primal primal animal here, so I apologize. Power, you're one of the best. You know that. You know we love you, and we always go to you for both the fun stuff, but also some of the introspective stuff. So thank you for taking some time here as you're getting ready to pack up and head to Mid-Ohio and hopefully do some great things for yourself, for Team Penske, for Chevy, Verizon, and so on. So thanks for taking some time here, my man.
Yeah, always a pleasure. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.